So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar, and this week I'm joined with our other Senior Editor, we have many, Daniel Cooper from the UK. Hey, Dan.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here, and
hello.
Thanks for having me back.
Dan has kicked out Sherlyn, who needs a desperate vacation. So Sherlyn had to do a lot of work over the past few weeks. She basically got all those Samsung reviews one after another. So we all forced Sherlyn to take a break, and we took away her computer and her internet. So I think she's okay. But she'll be back next week, so sit tight for that. We'll be talking about some news, some of the news we missed over the last 2 weeks. And also stick around for the end of this episode. I'll have a short interview with Neil Blomkamp about his next movie, Demonic, and how he's using basically virtual backgrounds on that thing. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget Podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's always super helpful. You can also drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. Send us your feedback, Q&A, anything like that. That's always super helpful. And you can also join us typically every Thursday around 10 a.m. Eastern for our live stream. You'll get to see behind-the-scenes action of the show, and we'll do more Q&A there too. So sometimes we get to do hands-on with products. Stick around for that. So Dan, we're just going to get right into the news, because I feel like as people who write news, it kind of like irks me when we can't talk about something for 2 weeks and we have this whole backlog of things. So we didn't have a show last week. Everybody took a break, and everybody deserved the break. Now we're into full swing. One of the things we're getting ready for this fall is new iPhone season, the iPhone 13 or whatever the hell it's going to be called. I will put money that it won't be called iPhone 13.
I don't think it will be called the iPhone 13, the iPhone 13 either. And someone, a very prominent journalist, called me out on this on Twitter. But I really feel strongly that I don't think Apple would tempt fate like that.
There are so many cultures around the world where 13 is a bad number. It's totally avoided. If you live in a apartment building, you probably don't have a 13th floor. Most hotels don't have 13th floors. So it's stuff like that that I think will keep them away from it. But I guess we'll see. One of the craziest rumors I saw over the past few weeks, though, is an analyst, Ming-Ching Kuo, said that Apple is working on bringing satellite connectivity into the next iPhone, which to me is wild. I don't know if you guys have ever seen a satellite phone, but they're typically like big, rugged things. If you watch any of those like nature shows, sometimes people have them because it gets you the basics of phone connectivity when you're in the middle of nowhere. But to think of that in something that's like a sleek iPhone, to me, is pretty wild. Did you have any thoughts on this, Dan?
Do you know what? I've got two thoughts. The techno-optimist part of my brain says, isn't it amazing that in the better part of a decade, we've gone from, the first iPhone, which didn't even have 3G.
Yeah.
And now we're at the point where, if this comes true, obviously, we're going to have, these absolutely kind of ridiculously thin phones that can do satellite communications, and that
we'll see.
An extraordinary achievement. The other part of my brain obviously thinks that this is, if it does come to fruition, it feels very much like the narrowest niche of a narrow niche in terms of who it will appeal to. I get why, because there are certainly in the US, if you're outside of the major sort of population areas, you may not have reliable cell service, but you're marketing a phone to the entire population of the earth at this point, and you're saying, well, for the people who are sort of dotted around, spend upwards of $1,000 so that you get this feature. And if they're going to lead with that, I feel like it may not necessarily appeal to everyone who can get service on the subway and may not be worrying about whether they can get service at the top of a mountain.
It's tough. Like, I'm sure Apple could figure this out. We have the tech for it. I hear, like, you know, there are Qualcomm chips that can enable satellite connectivity. But to be clear, what it is it's just making calls. I think it can do text, but this isn't like heavy data. This is, you're in the middle of nowhere. You know, you're stuck under an avalanche or something, and you need to call for help. And you need a phone that can actually get some sort of signal to get a call so you could call emergency services. But in America, hey, yeah, that's important.
Think about the marketing of this, though, because in the same way that it only takes 4 or 5 people to get like a red light on their Fitbit and they go to the hospital and it turns out that they were minutes away from a heart attack, you need is 1 or 2 people saved from near death in an avalanche. And you can basically say, well, you know, the iPhone, it's not just a bougie toy. It saves lives.
It did it. Hey, if they can make that happen without like raising the cost of the phone, and also without like, it would have to be another service you subscribe to. Like, this wouldn't be part of your Verizon or T-Mobile or AT&T service. Like, there are satellite phone companies that offer separate services, so it would have to be part of that. Yeah, in the U.S., it's like if you go to the middle of the woods, but like really far into the middle of the woods or up a mountain or something. It's not places where people actually go, unless you're like vacationing. So I don't know how realistic this is. And also, I do feel like we're still trying to figure out like what the hell is going on with 5G. The rollout in America has been kind of crappy. Not sure how it's looking on your side, Dan.
It's the funny thing is in the UK, it happens very slowly and then all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm still on an older iPhone, so I haven't seen it. But my wife, who's got the iPhone 12, it's very weird because we're in quite a small city, comparatively speaking. And all of a sudden, she's getting 5G notification, you know, sort of it's switching over. And she's sort of baffled because we haven't heard anything yet. But I think we are now, we're at the point where it's no longer news when an area gets 5G.
It doesn't really mean anything either. Like, I don't know if you guys have noticed any major speed improvements. That's a thing we'll be talking about moving forward. Actually, related to this, folks, I don't know if you all have seen the news, but we are no longer part of Verizon Media Group. We are now Yahoo. Our company has officially been sold to Apollo. Is it Apollo Media Group? It's been sold to a private holding group. We are rebranding as Yahoo. We can disparage Verizon as much as we want now, I think. Is that how it works? But yeah, we'll be talking about 5G across America and the world. But yeah, things are changing over here. Who knows what the next iPhone will bring? I'm like personally not super excited for this one, but I guess we'll see what happens. There's also a bit of other Apple news. They announced late last night that they're going to allow some media apps to link outside of the App Store for payments, which is apparently it's just one link, and it's only like certain types of media apps, but it's something. Right now, if you download the Netflix app on your phone, for example, you can't sign up for Netflix service from within iOS, because that would go through Apple's processor. They take a, you know, what, 30% chunk. Yeah. That's been the whole story, you know, for now. Now, Apple, I believe it was in response to the Japan Fair Trade Commission. Like, there have been a lot of complaints from developers about how Apple is handling the App Store. This is like one minor concession. It's like one link. Please, you could go over here, go to the internet, the dirty worldwide internet, and pay for a service there. That's something, at least. Yeah,
it's savvy. It's savvy. It feels very Apple in so much that they've waited until just before the world's regulators forced them to do something, because, you know, I think that governmental pressure is coming. And it's coming very quickly.
Yes.
And they've done, at the very last minute, they've done less than the bare minimum with the, you know, the A, it's only reader apps. B, it's a very limited, still very heavily prescribed method of communication. But it's probably just enough that means that, so, you know, for instance, in the EU, we've got Spotify basically saying we want a more direct relationship with our customers and Apple. Apple is getting in the way. Well, now Apple can say, well, no, we're not, you know, without conceding a single thing,
right,
they can
right.
say, no, our position has evolved. Now you can access it. You know,
you have a link.
You have a link. And it's in a way, it's the sort of evil genius that you have to applaud.
Mm-hmm.
Whether regulators do or not is another story, but
We'll see. And, you know, I've seen people are still making the argument that, hey, this is Apple Store. They could do whatever they want. I do think, like, when something becomes so dominant as the App Store has become, you know, Apple is no longer a bit player in this market. You know, they are a driving force. I do think, like, there are certain points where these platforms need to be forced to open up if they're big enough. And to actually innovate, these things need to happen. There's also a little bit of Apple news. I saw Gabriel in the chat drop this, but they are allowing digital licenses in a couple states. Georgia is going to be one of them. I believe Arizona is going to be one of them. That's just another piece of news that's interesting. I think it's really only relevant when you're in the airport, because the TSA will be able to, like, you'll be able to, like, tap it with your Apple wallet. You'll be able to tap your phone on the thing and they'll see a digital version of your license. This isn't a thing where you should be handing your phone over to a cop or something. But I don't know. Does that sound appealing to you at all? Dan, like, no. Having the backup on your phone? No?
No? No, anyway, I'm one of these people who I'd never buy a smart lock for the simple reason that I would never use my phone as my primary way of opening my car. I want it to be that if I get mugged or it smashes or it runs out of battery, I am not locked out of my entire life. I like this has blown up in my face once when I was coming back from IFA and I had real train tickets and I was getting off the platform at Heathrow Airport and my train ticket home, which was, you know, sort of probably the equivalent of about $110, fluttered out of my wallet and kind of onto the rail and then got smashed by the train as it came in. And they wouldn't print me a repeat. That's a fraud prevention thing. But of course, what that meant was...
They could see the charge in your credit card and be like, okay, you just bought a ticket.
Yeah, they could, but this is Britain. You know,
it sounds like Britain customer service. I know people who... I know the buses don't stop for you. You know, really, they will force you to run and get up to the... I know people who've been left in the side of the road in the middle of nowhere, like country towns, because they didn't have the appropriate papers to continue the trip to France and whatnot. So, yeah. British customer service, gotta love it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you felt because you lost your paper ticket. That was a bad thing. Things like that, like train tickets and whatnot, especially when I was around New York and when I take flights, like that's all on my phone, but I do have the paper backup. And to me, that is just like an important peace of mind thing. So I like to be able to have the backup filed away somewhere in case my phone fails. But typically I just want to show the phone. I think that's generally more convenient. Have like a privacy concern here by having official government ID on your phone, Dan?
Do you know what? I don't so much as just the idea that I like... I just don't want to be reliant on a single device. I feel you know, there's always that risk that we put our entire lives on our phones and then as soon as it kind of reaches this privileged position in our lives and it breaks or we lose it or anything else. And you can sort of imagine kind of running around asking people for their phone and they think, get away from me, you're a crazy person. And then before you know it, you know, your whole life gets turned upside down. So I quite like having not all of my life, some, but not all of my life.
Yeah. It's a nice balance. I think like having Apple Wallet in general has been really nice. Like, especially now during the pandemic, it's like when I'm going to a store, I don't want to like fumble and pull out my credit card and swipe in this reader. Also, you cannot trust like credit card readers because people like to put like the hacky card readers in there too. So it's like if you just tap your phone and that's a digitally encrypted signal that doesn't even show your real credit card number, that is always going to be safer. So in that respect, it's nice to have a little bit of connectivity. But I hear you, Dan. Listeners, definitely let us know what you think about putting your license plate or your license, your driver's license on your Apple Wallet. Is that something you're going to be using? Let us know. I think... other bits of news we saw, Microsoft announced a couple things over the last couple weeks. A Surface event on September 22nd, that was this week, and also that is 2 weeks before Windows 11 is officially launching on October 5th. Are you excited for this, Dan? Have you seen Windows 11 in action yet?
Seen it in action. I've read all the previews and...
at Engadget.com.
I've lost the ability to speak. It's great. You put a microphone in front of me and I just start burbling. I can't find myself getting enthused about Windows 11. I mm-hmm. get all of the fact, you know, all the quality of life updates, but I don't really feel as if it's as earth shattering. It may, you yeah. know, maybe I'm just
it's dulled. Not earth shattering. Yeah. No. Yeah. It's nice. It's a nice change of pace. Like, I have it right now on a Surface Laptop 4 that is sitting next to me. I'll be testing it more on my main desktop soon. But yeah, it's here's the thing, folks. Windows 10 was really good. Windows 10, yeah. like, totally fixed everything that was wrong with Windows 8. It felt like it was harkening back to Windows 7. Our Windows 10 review is actually one of the first big ones I did here at Engadget. That's, like, 2015. So, like, even, like, it felt good from the beginning, and I feel like Microsoft has only made it stronger. Windows 11 does feel like the remnants of that Windows 10 X plan they had for dual screen devices, which kind of all fell apart. It seems like, you know, a feature upgrade that was transformed into a whole new OS in a way. Do you get that sense, Dan?
Yeah, I do. I think mm-hmm. As I said, it's quality of life updates rather than anything yep. earth-shattering. Although the new... kind of bundle the icons in the middle of the bottom of the taskbar. I'm saying nothing, but it definitely feels like they've definitely mm-hmm. Tried to adopt another company's UI. I can't think of the name of the company.
They've macked it up, but you know what? if you've been looking since Windows 7, the icon only taskbar has existed since then. It just wasn't centered. But also, like, hey, I talked about this in our previews. People trade, like, these companies trade design ideas back and forth. Like, Apple has taken a lot from Windows, and Microsoft is taking a lot from Apple at this point. And I do have to say, just using Windows 11 on my test device, like, it's very elegant. It is very nice. Like, I think there are more, like, visual design flourishes here than we typically expect from Microsoft. So I'm interested to see how people respond to it. It feels like a mature Windows in a way. Windows 11 coming October 5th. There's also some confusion with how Microsoft is doing the install, like allowing installs. They've gone back and forth on that with a lot of folks. The Verge last week reported that Microsoft is also letting anyone install Windows 11 ISOs, which is interesting because right now there are all sorts of like upgrade requirements. If you're trying to bring a Windows 10 PC into Windows 11, you need to have secure boot. You need to have like basically a lot of secure elements and a pretty modern processor. Basically, if you have a CPU that's older than 4 years and you don't have secure boot and everything, you can't upgrade into Windows 11, but you can download, you know, the ISO, put it on a USB disk or burn it to a DVD. Oh my God. But you can put it on a device and install it manually, which I guess is great for enthusiasts and like IT people, but maybe not regular users. Have you been following the madness around Windows 10, like Windows 11 installation?
I think mm-hmm. fundamentally it's a sort of sop to those customers who were using big, you know, they've got this big infrastructure and they just want to kind of grab, they want to grab an ISO and see whether they can get Windows right. 11 working to a level that they can still do their business on it. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that they've sort of very publicly discussed that. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, I think most companies, I think, would sort of keep that information to their sort of pro channels, to their IT channels, rather than announcing it to everyone.
It's true. Yeah.
But it's nice. I mean, I'm sure there is older hardware that will probably be able to run it. If you know,
it's fine.
You'll get a reduced experience, but you will be able mm-hmm. to run it. And I applaud Microsoft for saying, well, you know, the ISO is available. Take your chances.
Take your chances. As a former IT guy, I always look for the ISO. Like, I used to have a bag that was just like, okay, emergency Windows. It was Windows XP. It was Windows ME Vista. Like back when I was doing IT stuff at school, I had to have all this stuff to be able to fix everyone's computers. Having a separate Win 11 ISO is nice. There is an argument from a lot of people that it seems like Microsoft is pushing people to basically upgrade their computers, maybe unnecessarily. I'm not sure how you feel about that. Or like, I'm not sure how I feel about that. I don't get that sense, but is it like from your perspective, Dan, does it seem like they're kind of pushing people to upgrade too because of all these requirements?
Do you know what? It's more that mm-hmm. Whilst Windows 11 is the newer thing, I don't really see why you can't linger on the current system for a long while. I'm sure Microsoft will pull pull support for it at some point in the
future.
They
said like 2025 is when, like, you know, that's a ways away. Yeah.
So even if you buy a machine now, and it can't, well, I guess you, there's
if
no
you buy a machine now, it will definitely work. Yeah.
Yeah. If you bought a machine maybe 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it can't run, for whatever reason, it can't run Windows 11, you're still going to get sort of 6 years of life out of, or use out of it, and probably a little mm-hmm. bit more, because Microsoft is famous for always pushing back support.
Absolutely.
So yeah. I think given the kind of the massive blob that is all of those PCs that are running Windows, this mm-hmm. is the only way you can sort of stagger and manage that transition, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, previous versions of Windows have always struggled with this backwards compatibility issue, where, you know, the OS gets so massive because you're trying to serve every single customer who has a even vaguely compatible machine. This feels like a fair, annoying for those people who are kind of caught on the cusp, but
yeah, yeah.
But it's a fair compromise.
It also, like, not to defend Microsoft too much, but yeah. It is really hard to make massive system-wide changes, because Windows has to support like a lot of stuff, like way back to Windows XP. So they're kind of limited in what they could do. This feels like on the heels of the various CPU vulnerabilities we saw a couple of years ago on Intel and AMD chips, like they are trying to really lock down Windows into a more secure environment. So, hey guys, like if you want like less malware, if you want like a potentially less vulnerable PC experience, a lot of these restrictions will be really useful. But like you're saying, Dan, I don't think you're left out in the water. The one big thing is that there is, what is it, DirectX 12 Advanced, like the highest level of gaming performance, along with their new memory technology, the stuff that's in the Xbox Series X and S. That is only going to be on Windows 11. So gamers, I think, are going to feel that need to really get the, you know, upgrade if they can. If you built your own rig 2 or 3 years ago, you may be high and dry if you used an older CPU. So, you know, it's going to be bumpy. It's going to be rocky. I'm sure a lot of people are going to complain. But I hope for the broader PC market that it's going to be, you know, worth the jump there. Let's move on to this other story, and a pretty important one too. September 1st, which would be, yesterday as of this recording, major Twitch streamers have organized the hashtag Day Off Twitch to protest hate raids and Twitch's inability to help to prevent those, basically. And I don't know if you guys have seen this in action, but typically it's been like women and people of color who are streaming on Twitch, just like bots, spamming their chats with hateful messages and things that will flood their actual fans and also distract the streamers and basically make it a really toxic environment for them. I think this protest was totally necessary because Twitch has not done much to protect marginalized voices. So, you know, it's a thing I'm going to shout out, and we will probably follow up on this like as we hear more about it. But it's a big deal. Like, people are trying to broadcast and put themselves out there, but it's also just as easy for haters and, you know, people who are outright racist and bigots to kind of drown them out too. So this is the kind of war we're at.
Do you know what? I'm going to go very broad about this, because mm-hmm. one of the big curses of a lot of these platforms that are essentially asking for user-generated content, I think what they have always been very lax about is moderation and being proactive about moderation. And there's a conflicting incentive there, because the more you moderate, the less content there is, the less material you can sell advertising against. And so it harms the bottom line. Whereas really, the end result is, which we've seen on Facebook, we've seen on Twitter, we've mm-hmm. seen on pretty much every major social platform, certainly over the last 5 or 6 years, is that the lighter the touch you have, the more problematic things get. And then you you know, this sort of these sort of drive-by attacks, which are designed really to shut down streamers, because obviously when you start having all this, you know, all this kind of language thrown into the chat, then you have to get moderators involved. Then the onus is on the streamer who's, you know, potentially not controlling their own guests, or they're not mm-hmm. being proactive enough. And it's very much the devil's bargain. And I think a lot of these platforms are going to have to reckon with this sooner rather than later, because if they don't, they're going to find they're going to find people leaving purely because they, you know, they don't feel welcome, and they will take those audiences away, and they will lose money in the longer term as well. And it's a really big, tough problem, but it's also one that if they don't get serious about soon, it is going to hurt them, and it's going to hurt them very badly.
Mm-hmm. What I love about this, especially online communities, is that, hey, you know, if we're not being supported by the big corporation that's, you know, powering the service, we're going to come up with our own tools. So people have come up with like all these sorts of like hacks and third party solutions. There's like a panic button, which I think is kind of interesting. It basically takes the chat immediately into limited mode, and it limits like the ability of new users with abusive names to join. You know, that sort of thing is useful. But hey, Twitch, owned by Amazon, like these things, these companies should be able to better support these services. I do think a lot of them, especially when it comes to user generated content, they assume they could just sit back and like let money be printed and not do much to actually support it. And I think we're getting to the point where that's really not true. If you have a platform, you got to support it, and you got to protect your people. And speaking of platforms, I think we want to pour one out for Locast, the local network streaming solution here in the U.S. I love Locast. Locast has been the way I, if I'm watching the Oscars, or if I need to watch something that's only broadcast on like network TV, for the past couple of years, I've lived in places where like an HD TV antenna just doesn't pick anything up. Locast has been a big help, but it's dying. And you did a great write up, Dan, of specifically what is going on and what's bringing it apart. This morning, as we're recording this, they just announced that Locast is officially dead. But Dan, how did we get here?
So, if I'm allowed to go on a slight
always,
ramble, I guess
always yes.
One of the problems is just the very complicated nature of broadcasting, analog broadcasting, and the laws that govern it in the US. And to a certain extent, you know, there is television that you can pick up for free with an antenna, but also there's television that you are legally entitled to receive for free. Mm-hmm. But if for whatever reason you can't receive it, you're also pretty much prohibited from accessing it through the internet for various copyright-based reasons. And this is one of the things that Locast was designed to tackle was the Aereo problem. If you don't remember, or I should say if the listeners don't remember, Aereo was a New York-based for-profit company that essentially tried to digitize. You know, they had a building in New York with loads of antenna on the roof, and they were all
it was amazing. Like, specifically, like, Aereo's thing was like, we have HDTV antennas. We have one for every person streaming, and that is how we're getting around every like restriction on this. Brilliant, but it was too much for this world, apparently. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that Locast was designed to test was the legal case for rebroadcasting under the Communications Act. Now, I don't know what your kind of grounding in the law is, but there are certain
not much.
Times...
I followed like media stuff as much as I can, but you're the law guy, Dan. I know you followed legal procedures quite a bit. Yeah.
So you know, there are times when people will set something up as a test case, and that can be, you know, for consumer rights. It can be basically to say, I have set this up with the intention of being sued in order to provoke a legal argument and receive some kind of settlement. And David, I want to say good friend, the guy who founded Locast, is a lawyer and a former FCC lawyer. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, if you run it as a non-profit, then you get around the Aereo problem.
Yep.
By basically doing what Aereo did, but you can say, well, actually, we are a non-profit rebroadcasting outfit. All we're doing is adhering to the kind of the accessibility requirements of the Communications Act and the FCC guidelines.
If I can't get the stream, which I should be getting as somebody who lives in America, like, truly using another service to help me get it should be legally fine, right?
And it is. I mean, if you are, and I did, I buried myself in the documents for this yesterday. If you're, I think it's one side of the Louisiana River. Your station has a different name, but you know, whatever local station there is, someone else, a third party, is legally entitled to rebroadcast that signal within the sort of the edges of its footprint to make sure that everyone who that local station serves is able to access it. And so this was set up with that intention, with the intention of testing whether this legal protection would work. And the networks say, actually, this wasn't a philanthropic enterprise. This, you know, the dude who founded it is very close friends with high ups at AT&T and Dish Network. And, you know, there is, I better say, reportedly, and there's a Wall Street Journal or a New York Times piece on this from 2019, where the idea is that several prominent media executives in the kind of the pipeline business gave money or helped the founding of this company. And the big network said, well, actually, what you're doing is you're using a loophole to get around paying us carriage fees, because you know, this is essentially a money dodge, because you're paying this supposed nonprofit. And Locast, I think Locast was sort of doomed, A, by the fact that the networks were never, ever, ever going to not bury this company in litigation. And also because the court found that Locast was earning way more money. When you're a non-profit, you know, obviously there were rules about how much money, surplus money. I won't call it profit, but obviously, you know, there's surplus money after running costs.
Revenues, I don't know.
Whatever you want to call it. And Locast was taking significantly more money in than it needed for running, and also it was using some of that money to push into other territories, other states in the US. And the court said, well, you are, broadly speaking, you know, you are walking like a for-profit enterprise and quacking like a for-profit enterprise, and so therefore we are going to remove the sort of the legal shield that was keeping you running. The EFF said that this was, you know, a very flawed judgment, and I'm a little bit surprised that Locast has just shut down. I don't know whether it's a case that they just felt it isn't going to be worth pursuing it because the big networks have so much money and they have so much to gain, or they have so much to protect from this, that they're just going to, you know, bury the company. But I would imagine that, and you know, give it 2 or 3 years and another company will try this, or another project will try this very same thing, until there is real sensible reform of the media broadcasting landscape, because it's not going to work. This idea that you cannot, you know, that the accessibility provisions for analog broadcasting cannot be imported to the internet because of reasons, because we want people to buy a Hulu subscription or anything else. There is going to have to be a change here, because otherwise, you know, as analog TV goes away,
it's gone.
People are going to be,
it's not here in the US anymore. We you know what I mean, though? Like, analog signals. Yeah. So is this an argument, Dan? Like, I'm just thinking, like, if before, analog signals were a thing that were legally required. Now, broadcast networks, which take a lot of money from the government, are required to, you know, spit out digital signals that anybody should have access to. Is Locast just an argument for a nationalized form of, like, hey, there should be an America streaming service, you know, that gives you all your broadcast networks that everybody can just access, depending on their location? Like, to me, that's what the argument seems to be here. But I don't know if we'll ever see that, you know?
It does sound very communist.
Yeah, so, yeah. How dare I? But, yeah, these companies are taking government money, folks, like, because they're producing something that should be legally accessible by people in America. So, hey, just a thought, just putting that out there. I know in the UK, Dan, you guys pay money towards the BBC, right? Like, that is how you get access to that.
It's a slightly complicated situation. So we have two major channels. We have the BBC, which is essentially paid for by an annual tax on the right to receive the BBC, more or less. There, it's complicated. I'm paraphrasing. And then you have Channel 4, which is essentially PBS, but PBS with the idea of it runs commercials and it pays for itself.
Yep.
sort of through the running of commercials.
I feel like most of my favorite shows over the last decade come from Channel 4, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Channel 4 has always been a little bit off the wall. It's certainly less so now. It kind of 10 years ago, it trended very middle class. It went from being very weird art shows and shows really designed to sort of highlight communities, sort of minority communities and everything else. And now it's very much kind of property shows and dating shows and reality shows. And, you know, it's trended very middle of the road. But essentially, there's always some really interesting stuff that comes out of Channel 4. Channel 4 was the first channel to give, it gave Charlie Brooker Black Mirror.
Yep.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who obviously everyone loves now, they commissioned her first sitcom, Crashing, which came out slightly before Fleabag.
Mm-hmm. That's on Netflix now too, so
yeah.
That's a cute thing, but nowhere near as good as Fleabag. Yeah,
yeah, it's not.
Yeah,
but so you have that, and then you have ITV Channel 5. ITV is for profit. Channel 5 is owned by Viacom, I think now, and then you've got Sky, which is owned by Comcast. So you have a fair mix of sort of not for profit, or not for profit, but sort of, you know, public service, public spirited broadcasting, and then pay TV. Behind sort of Sky's paywall and the cable paywall. And it's the fact that you get at least the first sort of five channels and then a lot more free as well. And the service is pretty much universal. If you want the premium stuff like movies or sports, you have to pay. And certainly if you want like the premium dramas, you have to pay. If you want like the HBO stuff, you have to pay.
But
by and large, you get enough content universally that you know it's not a mishmash.
Gotcha. Well, you know what, thank you for all the updates. I have a full understanding of how broadcast works now in the UK, Dan.
You're gonna
thank
cut
you very much.
All of this out now, aren't you?
No, well, I think it's really interesting, and people should know like how things work in other countries too, because I think that's really super informative. So hey folks, Locast is dead. RIP Locast. Let us know what you think about it. Did you use Locast? Was there a reason for it? Do HD antennas not work for you where you live? Because that was a big thing. My last apartment in New York just had thick concrete walls, and just like no matter what I did, I couldn't get anything. So let us know about your experience, and do you think there should be a nationalized broadcast network streaming service like I'm pitching here? Let us know. podcast@engadget.com. All right, let's move on to some audience Q&A from our folks here in the chat room. As always, we record and broadcast around Thursdays at 10 a.m. Eastern. Join us on our YouTube channel, folks, and let us know. We have Q&A seconds most weeks, but this week I want to get some like actually into the show.
Someone asks, ACBC asks, which is harder, to pick a lock or hack a digital lock? You need to watch The Lock Picking Lawyer on YouTube, my friend. There is, you know, every lock is and every digital lock is pickable in about 5 seconds. It's terrifying.
Really? Even the keypad ones, or is it just smart locks? Because I do like a keypad lock, like the one where you get the numbers, and actually just we set those up in some doors of our home just because you don't want to be stuck somewhere. You don't want to be locked out, right? If you don't have a key or something. And the keypads generally seem safe. What is the keypad? What is the lock lawyer taught you, Dan?
Oh my god! So have you not seen it?
I've not seen it.
Oh, good grief! It's amazing. He's done a million videos at this point, and all he does he never shows his face. It's just him, like at a table. A lock comes in. He unpicks it. He's like, hey, so this is a lock. It's being sold by these manufacturers, and click. This is how you unlock it, by hacking it. And then he'll get like a digital lock, and he'll say, okay, well, this lock, all you need to do is get a very strong magnet, and you just go flick. And so many of these smart locks just get completely rendered useless by a strong magnet in about 3 seconds of effort. He did a great video explaining how you can hack like an NFC type system so that you can clone a key card. And that did, I mean, I think you have to have physical access to the key card like cover, you know, the actual scanner. But it is crazy how like a gifted, a talented, well-motivated individual can basically crack any physical security in about a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's slightly terrifying.
That's tough. I feel like any lock, just like any computer, right? Everything is hackable. If somebody is persistent and they have enough tools for it. But so my front door has one of the Yale keypad lock, which I think is really super useful. Because when we were on vacation, I could just like give a code to our cat sitter and she punches it in and just comes in and it locks off at a certain time of the day. That was always super useful. And funny thing is, like, when we were where we were staying, like by the beach somewhere, they had the same lock too, and that's how they get all the guests to get into and out of the houses. To me, that's a good thing, especially if you don't like connected locks. If you don't want something Wi-Fi connected, a keypad, as long as you can remember it and you don't mind like changing it or creating like guest codes for other people, I think that's generally like, that's a pretty nice thing. It is worth the extra cost because then you'll never be locked out of your house, which to me is always a concern. That's happened to me before, and now that I have a baby, I don't ever want to, you know, be locked out. Hamad Esumru is asking about features of accessibility in Windows 11. I do hear that Microsoft is trying to do better around that. I believe voice transcription and voice commands, I saw more support for that. In Windows 10, they did create ways to basically start transcribing anywhere, but I think that is more of a centralized feature in Windows 11, and assuming you have a good microphone, you'll probably be able to type all over, you know, the place with your voice. So I think that's a big push there. We've also seen that Microsoft has been, they care more about accessibility than a lot of other companies. They get a lot of, they develop that accessibility controller for Xbox, which lets people with all sorts of disabilities be able to play games. So I do think as a company, Microsoft is doing better than other folks. But yeah, we'll be paying attention to this. That's definitely like a note in our reporting around Windows 11.
Oh, someone called DCH Pictures mentioned that we didn't mention Reddit. We didn't mention that Reddit was also going through a similar moderation problem with Steve Huffman. I don't know if you want me to talk about it now.
Go for it. Go for it.
So very briefly, Steve Huffman, like there was a lot of concern about COVID-19 misinformation, and there was a very popular subreddit of sort of promoting COVID denial and vaccine refusal and all of these other really smashing things. And CEO Steve Huffman released a post saying, well, you know what, this is marketplace of ideas, free exchange of information. We can't just go around shutting down protests left, right, and center, blah, blah, blah. God. And then very swiftly, a huge amount of subreddits went dark, which, you know, they don't sort of go off, but they sort of shut down so they can't be discovered by new users. And, you know, 24, 48 hours later, they take down this sort of big centralized vaccine denial group because actually, yes, it's not the marketplace of ideas. It's just bad. And it's
just bad. Yeah. It is funny how we're like, I think the libertarian ideal of the internet is like, yeah, free exchange of ideas. Anything is fair game. Right. And we start to see the limits of that. And I think when we're going through a major societal catastrophe, you know, an event that is affecting the health of millions of people, like everybody on this planet, information and bad information can be dangerous. And the internet as a mechanism, yeah, it can be lethal. It is leading, like in America, I don't know how things are on your side of the pond, Dan, but right now people are taking horseworm medication. Joe Rogan, the popular podcaster, just announced he has COVID-19 and he is taking, is it ivermectin? He is taking that. Even though this is the same guy who said, if you're healthy and a virile man, you don't have to worry about COVID. I hope somebody confronts Joe Rogan about these contradictions on his very popular show. But yeah, information can be dangerous. And I do think like all these services, so Facebook is dealing with this now too. If your platform exists to, you know, let people be social and spread information around, we kind of have to be careful, especially when we're amidst this pandemic. Sure, you could do whatever you want, like once we get out of COVID. But man, this is not the time to be telling people to be going down conspiracy angles when their health is at risk and people around them are at risk.
I think it's interesting what topics get initially, I mean, initially in this case, but sort of get covered by the marketplace of ideas defense. And you notice that it's always ones where there is a certain group of people who are very willing to sort of very deliberately defend something that's almost indefensible. And I don't want to sound glib here, but let's say for instance, a couple of years ago, Instagram had a real problem with eating disorder content. And eating disorder content was fairly universal. Like, I don't remember Joe Rogan or anyone else going to the battlement saying, oh, no, no. Or Steve Huffman saying, oh, no, no. Marketplace of ideas, we have to encourage a community of, you know, kind of prominently teenagers into listening to people basically kind of putting out eating disorder propaganda.
Right.
I'm trying to not to sort of sound glib when I say this, but you know, everyone sort of generally agreed that was not the sort of thing that responsible platforms and responsible people would do. And yet with this, all of a sudden, oh no, 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 this is a reasoned debate. And I have no idea what the difference is between those two. But and I have no idea why one is treated with reverence and the other one is sort of generally accepted to not be a good thing. Mm-hmm. I'll leave that up for the listeners and viewers to decide. But I think it's really interesting that there seems to be a double standard here. And again, it goes back to this whole user-generated content thing where if you don't... In fact, you know what's really interesting? Really, what we're talking about is strikes. You know, the users and content generators who are making the profit, both for Reddit and Twitch, have gone mm-hmm. on strike in order to yep. protest the working conditions they're in. And maybe this is something that we will see more as we have these big global sort of connected networks. You have the ability for these people who are sort of performing a lot of unpaid or underpaid labor to mm-hmm. now organize and decide collectively, well, actually, this is an unacceptable situation.
Absolutely. And even if you're being paid well by these platforms, they still need to do right by you,
yeah.
is the thing. Like, a lot of arguments I've seen, too, is like, oh, man, these really popular streamers are making so much money. They shouldn't have to complain about anything. It doesn't matter. It doesn't, like, these platforms should do better about avoiding people. Yep. Mark Dibley asks, does Windows 11 have any further improvements for running Linux? I didn't see anything specifically around Linux, but the big surprise, I think, in Windows 10 is just how much Microsoft leaned on Linux. You know, when I was traveling to Seattle to cover Build, Linux was a big topic. Like, the developers loved having direct Linux support inside of Windows. I believe the Linux terminal? Is in there, and the stuff developers need that normally you'd have to boot into a Linux computer or a desktop, you know, Linux environment, you could just now do within Windows. I can't imagine Windows will Microsoft will stop supporting that or not double down on that, because the big thing I got from developers and from covering Build is that Microsoft is desperate. For the love of God, developers, please, please support us. And I think that's what we're going to see with the revamped Microsoft Store and everything. You know, the big problem with the Microsoft Store so far in Windows 10 is that a lot of people just didn't want to build apps for it. And there were a lot of restrictions for building those apps, too. They are loosening those up. We are hearing about the Microsoft Store redesign. That is going to be a big part of Windows 11 as well. And I'm sure a lot of that will come to Windows 10, too. But Microsoft opening up restrictions, allowing more types of apps into the store, and also I think they're taking less of a cut, far less than what Apple is taking from app developers. Those should all be things to entice them to get into the Microsoft Store. So hopefully they can make that work better in Windows 11. And Hamad S. Sumaru also asks, will old processors work in Windows 11? That is something Microsoft is continually updating us on. So if you look at the latest story we've written about their restrictions, it does seem like basically if your processor is older than 3 years, you may be out of luck. It may just not be supported properly. That has to do with like the way secure boot is supported and other features you know, that can make Windows 11 a lot more secure as an OS. It does feel like Microsoft is just trying to draw a hard line here. If enough people complain, though, they'll probably open that up even more. And like we're saying, if you built your own computer and you know you can't get in with you can't do the upgrade easily, you can always download an ISO, install Windows 11 manually. That should work just fine. Let's move on to what we've been working on. I just want to shout out a couple of things. I played 12 Minutes, the game from, is it Annapurna Interactive? Annapurna Interactive's game that we've been covering for a while. This is one starring James McAvoy, Willem Dafoe, and Daisy Ridley. It is a top-down perspective time loop game. You come home to a lovely dinner with your wife. A cop comes in and things go crazy. I have been waiting years for this game. I remember seeing the first demos for 12 Minutes in like 2015. This game has been in development for a very, very long time. And I spent maybe 6 to 8 hours with it, and I started really digging it. I think it's basically a point-and-click adventure game. You know, it is a game where you collect items, you drag items onto people or other items, and things happen. The time loop, which lasts about 12 minutes, lets you kind of keep going back and trying new things to resolve a mystery. The idea is that this cop says your wife has killed somebody, and he's trying to bring her to jail or worse. Things get pretty brutal in it. And that is the loop. That is the essential murder mystery you're trying to solve here. And I think the first couple hours were really good. I was really into this game. There were some like puzzle pieces where I was like, I basically spent a night thinking about it or dreaming on it. And like solutions for the game for other things I need to do kind of came to me in my subconscious, which I think is that's a sign of a good game and a good narrative. And then there's the second half of the game, which is one of the worst stories and certainly some of the worst twists I've ever seen in anything, not just any games, but in movies or books or anything. This game goes places. I'm not a big fan of where it goes. And I think that's especially infuriating, right? It's not like it just started out being a bad game, but it kind of got me being like, oh, I'm a new inventive type of spin on an adventure game. But it turns out the story it's actually trying to tell is very dumb, and the twists are not great. And man, you could watch YouTube. You could watch YouTube runs of this game. If you have Game Pass, I'd say it's worth playing the first couple hours just to see like how it works. But man, is it infuriating. Dan, was this the game you were going to try at some point?
No, I haven't heard of 12 Minutes. So could you, is it like a Groundhog Day type?
Yes, yes.
And then how does the solving, please explain more about the mechanics.
Well, it's like Groundhog, it is actually very exactly like Groundhog Day. Like as you go through this loop, you get more information and you find out some stuff about your wife's history. And then you could be like, you could start to give her information and prove you're in a time loop, which I think is kind of fun. Like, tell her things that you absolutely wouldn't have known or things she was going to tell you. Those parts of it, I think, are really cool. But man, this game just starts to fall apart when it gets to like the actual meat of the mystery and what is going on. And there are some like, I don't want to say Shyamalan twists here, because I think the cliche is that all Shyamalan movies are based around twists. That's not true. And that's a whole other 2-hour podcast. But go check out my review of Old at the Filmcast. That movie is all over the place too. I enjoyed Old a lot more than this movie is the thing, or this game.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is the harshest, given the reviews for Old, that is the harshest thing you could have said about this thing.
Dude is like, I think as a visual, and I think people don't know how to really judge this sometimes, but like his visual narrative capabilities, his ability to like tell you a story within the camera and how he moves the camera and whatnot, like visually he's great. As a writer, he's not. Hey, turns out this game, in that respect, this game is similar. I think visually it is really interesting. It's doing some really cool things. But when it comes to like the writing, the dialogue people are saying, and the ultimate like where the story goes, I think it's a huge mess. So anyway, check out my review of 12 Minutes. It's called 12 Minutes Ruins a Compelling Game Concept with Awful Twists. And you know, let me know what you think about it if you play a couple hours or if you finished it. I know a lot of people who just hate played this game because it got so ridiculous. They're like, I gotta see where this goes. And I'll be honest, like by hour six or seven, I was like, yeah, I really want to see like how this train wreck kind of concludes. So yeah, that was my impetus to keep going with the game. Other things I'm working on, I mentioned the Razor Blade 14 last time. That review should be going up today or tomorrow. It's going up this week. This is Razer's 14-inch gaming notebook. I really like it. It's really fast, but man, you also really start to feel the compromises in a 14-inch machine. It runs really hot. The keyboard is more cramped than I would like, and I feel like in a shooter where you're really hitting those WASD keys, you don't want your fingers to feel cramped there because that ruins the entire point of having a gaming laptop. So it's good. It's powerful. I like it a lot more than the Razer Blade Stealth 13, which is their 13-inch machine, which is really underpowered and incredibly overpriced. I don't think anybody should buy that computer. The Blade 14 at least like has a fit for it. I just wish maybe it was a little lighter or it was more differentiated from the Blade 15, which is, hey, Razer's premium notebooks are good. And the Blade 15 now weighs around 4.4 pounds. The Blade 14 weighs like 3.9. So it's like a half pound difference. It's not that much. And I do think like for a lot of people, the Blade 15 will just serve you better. But keep an eye out for my review. We've got a video of that going up too. Dan, what have you been working on?
So I've been, I've got a few things that I can't talk about yet that are going up in the near future, but I wanted to talk about the Pavilion Aero 13, which okay. I reviewed last week, mm-hmm. which I was genuinely surprised by.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of HP's sort of fairly low end machines.
It's a Pavilion, and so that's how you tell with HP, by the way. Pavilion's usually their lowest, and there's Spectre, and then there's Scepter, right? The one above that, yeah.
Yeah, but the idea behind this, because it's Aero branded, and so the Aero is like the thin and light, sort of really crazy light,
yeah.
Sub-brand there, and what they've done is they've made a genuinely surprising thin and light. I think it weighs, I can't remember if it weighs the same or it's like half a half,
you say 2.2 pounds, yeah,
2.2 pounds. I think it's the same as the LG Gram,
which is, yeah, but that's pretty light, yeah,
which is super light, but whereas mm-hmm. with the LG Gram you've got really hobbled performance.
Yeah,
this is running a, I want to say off the top of my head, a 5800U, mm-hmm. which is a Ryzen 7 5800U. Sure.
So that means it has a bit of Radeon graphics too. It's got
Radeon graphics. Yeah. It's surprisingly thin and light. The compromises are really obvious all over the thing. The display is, it's just an HD.
Yeah.
It's not HD because it's 16:10, but it's HD. Mm-hmm. Like don't write in. It's HD. the keyboard is fine, but it's too crowded. There's an extra function row, which annoys me. It's got half height arrow keys. It annoys me. The trackpad is very serviceable. But it's under $1,000 and it's got Radeon graphics. It's actually quite powerful. Like, it doesn't do well in benchmarks, fair enough. But in day-to-day stuff, I can play games on this thing perfectly well. Mm-hmm. I can work from this thing perfectly well. And it's in a body the same size and weight as an LG Gram, where you would normally get sort of super weak Core i3 performance in terms of the entry level model. And even I compared this to the XPS 13.
And how dare you?
I know, very controversially. But when you look at it from like a spec by spec basis, the XPS 13 is obviously a way more expensive, way nicer machine.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the performance and the weight, the Pavilion actually kind of edges out, because mm-hmm. certainly for the base model, I think the base model is what, $1,100, and you're getting a Core i3 with 8 gig of RAM, whereas this is, I want to say $949 or $999, and you're getting 16 gigs of RAM with this Ryzen 7 5800U, and it just wipes the floor. Like, it is a perfectly good machine for this target market, and
this is the benefit of Ryzen, by the way. Like, these new Ryzen chips super fast and generally cheaper than Intel stuff. And I think at the low end, yeah, like here, like you're talking about, like, yeah, you get a lot of performance and you get a little bit of graphics. And Intel has been working really hard with integrated graphics, and it's fine, but it's nowhere near as good as like what even a tiny bit of Radeon performance gets you here. Yeah. So you like this overall, Dan?
Yeah, I did. I mean, with the graphics, it's, I think what caps it and what holds it back with the benchmarks is that there's only 512 megabytes of RAM attached to the Radeon itself. So I think a lot of the benchmarks just almost refuse to run on that little RAM. But
that's crazy. I'm looking at your stuff, by the way, Dan. I'm looking at your benchmark table, and compared to the Surface Laptop 4 15-inch, which is my, that is my Windows 11 test machine sitting right here next to me, that thing has a Ryzen 7, the custom MS Microsoft chip. That maybe it's because you're looking at newer drivers and stuff too, but you've got like over 1,000 points more in PC Mark 10. Not as much in 3D Mark, but your Geekbench 5 and PC Mark performance is better. I think that also has to do with this being a Ryzen 5000 series chip, whereas the Surface Laptop 4 is, I believe, Ryzen 4000, so like slightly last gen. But that is pretty good performance, like you're saying.
It is surprising. And again, at this sort of price and in this sort of body shape, it is tremendously surprising. And I think, unrelated to this device, I feel like as more of these kind of thin and light Ryzen machines sort of filter through, Intel is going to have a real problem on its hands unless Pat Gelsinger can really kind of put a fire under Intel.
He's trying to do. But
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean he's done the thing of announcing a lot of very hard deadlines.
Yep.
But it's very easy to announce a hard deadline. It's and you know, no shade on Intel, who is, you know, as a company, is full of very smart people.
Lots of shade on Intel, I'd say. Like they deserve some shade. Yeah.
But yeah, they've got to kind of hit this now, and I don't know whether one change at the top is necessarily going to kind of change all of the engineering cul-de-sacs that they've been down. But I mean, hopefully Intel kind of pulls themselves out of this spin. AMD continue to grow, and we get the benefit of just amazing thin and light chips that don't suck.
Competition is great, folks. This is why competition is good. Like, AMD is pushing Intel to be better. To be honest, like, Intel being dominant was the thing that pushed AMD to really like whip up its designs too. So I'm running an AMD powered desktop now. For years I was just an Intel guy. So you know, you can go back and forth. Buy the chip that works best for your, you know, the things you actually need. But yeah, Dan, I'm glad you got to check out this laptop. I do like thin and lights. I want, like, I think the perfect laptop is around 2 pounds. That gives me all the performance I need. That's where ultra portables should be going. What else are you working on, Dan?
So the other thing, Saints Row is as part of the Gamescom. Saints Row Not 5 was announced. I have a little bit of a soft spot for Saints Row.
Love Saints Row, yeah.
I bailed out. Well, kind of everyone mocks my gaming taste because I like terrible games. So I have to kind of preface by saying,
you and Charlene need to have like a show together of just bad game times. Yeah. But yeah, what's up?
So I bailed out of GTA 4 and 5. Both of them just, I think, lost me because the narratives just sprawled so much. And there were so many side missions. Like, in terms of the content that both of those games have, you cannot fault them for like just the sheer amount of stuff. You get your money's worth out of that game, but I just found them getting very boring. And then you play a game like Saints Row the Third, and it's like being handed blue Skittles or blue M&Ms, the old fashioned ones with the food coloring that sent you loopy, you know? And
you're like, whoa.
Maybe it's like, you know, getting a Mountain Dew, like a giant gallon of Mountain Dew, and then just throwing you into a playroom and letting you just go absolutely crazy. And so I always had a soft spot for the Saints Row series because,
I mean, Saints Row the Third is when they went crazy. Basically, they're like, okay, we're just gonna go loco, you know. Grand Theft Auto tries to be grounded in reality. Saints Row is like, you get superpowers. Keith David's here, you know, like just like, yeah, it's crazy.
And those games are fun. They're not particularly replayable. Mm-hmm. I think they wear out their welcome fairly quickly, but then it's fun. It is that sort of fun hit mm-hmm. of just gonzo fun that yeah. carried it through 4 and then the DLC.
And 4 goes to a place where it's like, I don't know if you can actually continue this game anymore because you've gone so crazy where it's like, you've broken the narrative. Congratulations.
They did break the narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, this is what Volition basically said was mm-hmm. there was nowhere else for us to go with this story. This is their second reset, really, after Agents of Mayhem, which wasn't particularly well
received.
We'll
never talk about again. Yeah.
Yep. And so now they're coming back with this sort of clean sheet reboot, and it is definitely it seems a lot less gonzo. Mm-hmm. And certainly in the trailers so far and the developer interviews and everything else, they do seem to be aiming for a lot more serious.
Mm-hmm. And it's like Saints Row 2 almost all over again.
This is it.
Yeah.
It's very much, we're not going completely Grand Theft Auto, but we're sort of stepping away from Saints Row 3 and 4 levels of fun. I don't know whether I'm a little bit apprehensive. I'm nervous because I hope that it's not po-faced and tedious, and I hope that they've still got that fun, but they're holding that back purely as a sort of marketing tactic. But I will be buying it day one because I'm hoping it's going to be fun, and I'm hyping myself up for this. But yeah, I'm nervous about it.
It looks fun. I think that trailer is a lot of fun. I think the next game I'm really hyped up for is Deathloop, which we'll talk about quite a bit too. I think, Dan, have you played the Dishonored games?
No.
I think you will love the Dishonored games. I'm trying to that is my mission, is to try to get everybody onto it. Because it's like, it is like French fantasy. It is first person, but it's like French fantasy meets sci-fi. Great narrative and whatnot. It's first person, and I think it's the only game to get like first person sword fighting down well, even though you get projectiles and stuff. Anyway, everybody play Dishonored. It's on Game Pass. And Deathloop looks really cool too. Thank you for the update on Saints Row, Dan.
You are welcome.
Let's move on quickly to our pop culture picks. I've been watching Ted Lasso. I've been watching a lot of Ted Lasso, and I think something happened on the internet where it's like, was it? I wasn't completely following what's happening, because I think once this discourse started happening around Ted Lasso, basically there has been a backlash against Ted Lasso season 2, and I basically did the Grandpa Simpson walking into the bordello thing, where it's like, I walk in, I take a look, I just twist right around, like, whoop, right, no, I'm leaving the internet today. I think it's because of the Christmas episode, which, for full disclosure, both Dan and I have access to Ted Lasso screeners because we cover stuff from Apple TV Plus. Also, we're huge Ted Lasso fans. So, like, you know, it's a thing we wanted to be able to, like, you know, cover if we needed to. We've been gushing over the Christmas episode for a couple of weeks now. The broader world, a lot of other people saw the Christmas episode and they were like, this show was bad after all, it turns out. It turns out everything that's bad about Ted Lasso was in this Christmas episode. And I just think that's absolutely insane. But what are your thoughts on this, Dan? Because I'm trying to, like, talk about this without, like, seething in rage. It's like, we have one good thing in the world now. It's called Ted Lasso. Don't like ruin it with your bad discourse. But what's your thoughts?
It is, pardon me, it's very infuriating because it seems like the discourse machine had to at some point turn. And now that Ted Lasso is very popular, and, you know, I think the first season,
there was an arc of popularity, like towards the end.
It
people
was a
got
slow
in.
Burn. Yeah. And I think a lot of people were turned off with the idea, you know, it's a commercial they've made into a sitcom.
I was turned off. Like, I will be upfront, and I talked about this on the show. I never liked Jason Sudeikis. Like, I think he has, he has what you would call a punchable face. I think the movie Colossal, which I'm not sure if you've seen, Nacho Vigalondo film. I think Colossal is the thing that has made the best use of Jason Sudeikis, because the smarminess that is, like, underneath his nice guy exterior, that movie does a great job of, like, showing that. Whereas Ted Lasso is just all about, he's a nice guy. But we start to learn that there, you know, he has trouble. Like, there are things going on underneath the surface. But yeah, go on, Dan.
Okay, so What I tell you what, one of the things about the Christmas episode, which I guess people are waiting for the sort of the narrative other shoe to drop.
Right, right.
And what I find maddening is that this is a half hour sitcom. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not Succession series 3. Okay, people are treating Ted Lasso as if it is The Sopranos and Succession and The Wire all rolled into one. And I will admit, as much as I have enjoyed the series, I do get that there is a certain degree of discomfort because several of the episodes that have already aired, I'm going to be fairly vague here just to avoid spoiling, several of the episodes that have already aired end on what could conceivably be described as a cliffhanger, and yep. then it is ignored yep. afterwards.
Mm.
But it is a sitcom, first and foremost, and so it is existing in a world that is slightly, not completely, but it is slightly heightened. So stop expecting gravity to behave in the same way. It is a sitcom. Secondly, one of the things that you put it this way, one of the things that me and Dev know but we can't talk to you about is that some of the plot lines are going to take a little bit of a left turn, and certainly the episode that airs not this week but next week is very much kind of drops an emotional grenade in your lap, and it's not necessarily that all of the plot lines converge, but as a standalone episode it just feels as if a tipping point is reached, and I think that's why Apple haven't sent out screeners beyond that point, because I think they know full well that this is why the discourse so far is wrong. And the other thing I will say is, and I said this the last time we were discussing Ted Lasso on this very podcast, is that I didn't trust Bill Lawrence and Jason Sudeikis, because it did seem like they were just ripping off Major League and it was very two-dimensional. And then at South By... Well, here's the thing. At South By this year, Bill Lawrence said, yeah, we fooled you because the first couple of episodes are essentially just a rip-off of Major League in terms of the narrative. And then there's this sharp left turn and all of a sudden it changes. And you have to understand the discourses people right now is that... these are talented, really clever people who understand the environment in which the sitcom is being watched and received. And they are playing I think it's fair to say, agree with me or not, I think they're playing a different game to the one that everyone is expecting them to play.
I mean, that is the entire season too. Like this season, minor spoiler, but this season begins with a beloved character killing a dog. You know, that is the beginning of Ted Lasso season 2, a show that has been, you know, heralded for just being about positivity and feel good and niceness. So I think they're always trying to swerve and go here. I'll say, like, yeah, both of us have had screeners. A lot of folks are watching Ted Lasso week to week. Like, that is how it's being released. I do wonder if it was just, like, dumped as, like, a bingeable thing, if people wouldn't be talking about it this way. But also I'm seeing this response from a lot of critics too, who I know also have the later episodes. So it's like, I think there's a lot of stuff going on here. I'll just say up front, I love the Christmas episode. It definitely feels like a thing that has been added to a larger season, because it literally was. It was an extra episode, and I believe there's like another episode that's going to be that way too. Apple basically extended the season order. But watching the episode, I also felt like, man, this is a classic episode of TV. Like, I am going to revisit this every Christmas, and to see people just immediately reject it was just kind of surprising to me. But anyway, I think we're going deep on this. I think the main thing here is Ted Lasso season 2. It is fascinating to see how the internet is taking it. So yeah, we will talk more about this. Let us know what you're thinking about Ted Lasso season 2, folks. But we will probably do a wrap-up chat once the season is over.
Come on that one, please?
I will. Let's try to coordinate those times. But I also want to shout out Nia DaCosta's Candyman, which I saw in theaters. It sucks that things are once again getting bad in America, and I live in Georgia, which is a state that is very, very dangerous because people are being very dumb. But the one benefit of what is of how theaters are handling the pandemic now is that they're just desperate. So they're like open. They're open a little earlier. They're open at times where I can sneak in and there's like nobody there. So that is how I plan to do some of my stuff, especially for film reviews. Yeah, I saw Candyman in an empty theater, and it's tough. Like, I don't know how you feel about the original film, Dan. I love the original Candyman. Based on Clive Barker's story, was it based in London or the UK? Like, it was based in the UK, and then he transplanted it to Chicago. The director of the original film transplanted it to Chicago, and just in terms of it being a movie that was deeply about race and the state of America, and also just complete dread. Like, I love the original Candyman so much. This movie is a direct follow-up in many ways, but it doesn't have that same sense of dread. I think, like, it is almost like a cookie cutter redo of Candyman. There are some great, like, horror elements in here, like in terms of the kills and some of the set pieces, but it never felt scary. It never felt like, I never got that like skin tingling sense of dread that the original Candyman got me, which is kind of a shame. I'm just going to put that out there. So let me know if you guys like that. Just hit me up on Twitter about this one, probably.
I want to ask about this because I haven't read very much about this because I don't know how I feel about, because again, the original is a mood.
The original is like, it is all about like that the feeling it evokes in you. It has a Philip Glass score, you know, it has tremendous actors. Like Tony Todd is incredible in that movie. It is a mood. It has texture, which is a thing I like to talk about in films. To me, this film does not have texture. Like there is nothing to it in many ways, but go on, Dan.
Well, I was going to ask you, what's the, what is the sort of, if you can without spoiling it, what is the modern day update? Because I understand that it's they've tried to kind of give it a tech angle or whatever these days. So how have they tried to take something that's quite primal, quite sort of lizard brain in terms of the fear of having this person sort of pop up behind you when you're staring in a mirror? How have they changed that?
I mean, the basics are there, and what I love about the original film too is like, I think we all have these like folklore stories of like, you know, a thing, Bloody Mary or whatever, a thing you conjure in the mirror. But that original film also like it evoked like the horrors of racism in the US and kind of how that the stain on this country could kind of linger for decades or a century and become its own horror in a way. I think this movie kind of does that too. It also like it modernizes it too, because like hey, the Cabrini Green projects where the original was filmed have been knocked down in real life, and they've been replaced by condos, and this movie is talking about like, yeah, the condos that have been built upon that legacy, the people moving in and gentrifying the area. It is about a lot of things very obviously, but there is very little subtext to it. Like it is so blunt in a way. So anyway, I'm going to be talking about more about this on the Filmcast, my movie podcast, but I just wanted to shout it out, 'cause I know a lot of people were excited to see Candyman. Any shows you want to shout out, Dan, or movies?
Do you know what? The only thing I've been watching, apart from Ted Lasso, is Lower Decks, which great, I have to say great. I've been
Star
enjoying.
Trek Lower Decks. Yeah.
Yeah. Star Trek. Well, I don't think anyone's calling it Star Trek Lower Decks. Mm-hmm. I think we're just calling it Lower Decks.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us in the community,
the Trekkie hive, yeah, uh-huh,
yeah. We're just calling it Lower Decks. There's no need to preface everything. I don't like. I hated when they rebranded Enterprise in the third season to Star Trek Enterprise, because Paramount were worried that people couldn't grasp that the space show on a spaceship called Enterprise might not have been about like a Star Trek related series, but. Yeah, it's fun. I'm really it's the most fun out of all of the kind of the Paramount Plus now reboot era Star Trek shows. I think Lower Decks is head and shoulders above everything else. I'm enjoying it so much, and I'm enjoying.
Have you watched the first season when it came out, right? Or are you just watching the second season now?
Okay. No, yeah, I'm following on with the second season with the releases. Whereas I think I think we got a weird schedule in the UK, because I think it sort of hit Prime a couple of weeks afterwards. Whereas now we're getting it like the day after, or a week after. I can't
interesting. Remember.
But either way,
okay.
It's, Yeah, and I'm loving every minute. I'm loving spending time with these characters. And again, it's one of those shows whereby it's just nice to hang out. It's lovely to follow along, and it's never one of those shows that really demands you get like a big belly laugh, but it's a really fun way of spending half
it's
an hour.
Consistently, like, it's funny in the way that Rick and Morty is funny too, because it's by one of the former Rick and Morty writers, so it has that like vibe of like quick hit jokes and like great characters and great context. But yeah, I'm glad you're enjoying it, Dan. Anything else you want to add about that? Or we've never talked about Picard, but maybe that is a another discussion, because oh boy, what a mess.
Do you know what? If I had the time, I would be one of those guys who shoots like an hour long video about all of the things, but I don't care about like the canon and the context, but I think Picard had so many great ideas that were just so badly organized and so badly developed.
And
so much of it felt like all of the characters felt like they were pretending to do the things that they were doing, and the motivations weren't clear. And I think, I'm a big Michael Chabon. I've always said Chabon, but it's Chabon, apparently.
It's Chabon, yeah, but I love his books, yeah.
Yeah, his books are great. But all of the kind of the novelistic depth seemed to go. And I don't know whether it was him, because this is his first sort of major showrunning project, or whether it was Kurtzman doing his Kurtzman thing of just dumb it down, make it louder, make it dumber. But there were just so many moments where I felt this is a wasted opportunity. And it made me feel very sad. I will hate watch the second series. And if I get the time, I will make the hour long YouTube video. But I feel like if I do, I'm going to be marked off as one of those angry nerds who's just mad about things. Whereas I'm genuinely not.
I don't know. As we see from this podcast, I think that is going to be your new title, your new work title. Great. Thank you, Dan. I think let's wrap it up here. And don't forget to stay tuned to the end of this episode for our interview with Neil Blomkamp, the director of Demonic. Thanks for joining us, folks. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is usually produced by Ben Elman. I'll be editing this one, so send all the complaints to me. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter. I also do the Filmcast podcast at thefilmcast.com. If you want to hit up Sherlyn and see how she's doing on her vacation, she's at Sherlyn Lowe. Like, Dan, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Daniel W. Cooper, but I check it once a month. So
okay.
Any knee-jerk hate can wait.
Send Dan all your Star Trek opinions. You can email us at podcastandgadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify. Now let's move on to our interview with Neil Blomkamp. You may know his name. He's the director of District 9, Elysium, Chappie. He's a guy who kind of burst onto the movie world by creating these really special effects heavy films on really low budgets, and District 9 certainly made a splash. And with Demonic, he is trying to get back to the sort of like low budget digital filmmaking thing. His big draw with this movie is volumetric capture. He basically created these arrays to capture actors' performances from multiple angles, and that's something they could use to put them into 3D environments. It's kind of wild, but I'll let him explain it. Listen to our chat. Okay, thank you so much for talking with us in the Engadget podcast, Neil. Can you give us an overview of Demonic and, you know, what new technology you're bringing to it? I know you've talked a lot about volumetric capture here.
So the overview of Demonic would be that for many years, I've been very interested in films like Paranormal Activity and the Blair Witch Project, where filmmakers just went out and shot something themselves in the horror genre. And I always just found that really, really interesting. And I always wanted to do that at some point. So I had that idea in the back of my head, and actually Oates Studios and all of the stuff that we were doing and putting out on YouTube was very much cut from that same kind of cloth, where, you know, it was very much outside of Hollywood, and we were just doing what we wanted to do. So there was a point when the pandemic began where because everything had been shut down, and it was not clear exactly what was happening with the film industry until you know things became more clear, it was a perfect time to dig up this idea of a self-financed horror film and then just kind of work on it. And I'd also moved to a new area at the beginning of the pandemic, which is a bit more mm-hmm. rural. It's where the film is actually shot. And there were a bunch of locations that I thought would be interesting. So the movie is very unusual to the normal process, because the normal process is you just write the script and then you work backwards to make that happen. Where this process was, okay, we can self-finance a movie and it's tiny. So mm-hmm. what do we want to do? And what do we have access to with our limited resources? So I kind of think of it like we built it out of a bunch of different puzzle pieces. So, you know, before the story and the script existed, I knew that I wanted to use Carly in the lead because I went through the war zone in Oates production with her. And I knew that she'd be really good with low budget production. And I knew other Oates actors I wanted to use, like Michael Rogers and Chris Williams Martin. So then it was like, okay, what locations are we using? And so all of those things happened, but there was a moment where I realized that this obsession that I have with volumetric capture could be, because it was always sort of sitting on a mental shelf somewhere where it was like, I'd love to use this, but I don't really know how, because it's early and it's glitchy and I'm not sure how to put this into a movie. So that was the sort of, you know, the gelling component that sort of brought the film together, where because I knew there was something to do with demonic possession, it was small and self-financed, mm-hmm. it was in the horror genre. Once I brought this kind of more science fiction, sci-tech element into it, that's what led to the idea of demonic possession being explored through virtual reality. And
that's pretty cool. Yeah. It seems like a combination of both low tech, your self-financing, it seems like you're doing it like on location in many cases, but also high tech with the volumetric capture. That's a cool balance. Can you give us a sense of like, what do you mean by volumetric capture, and how does that process work for you as you're shooting it?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, volumetric capture is like motion capture in the sense that it's extremely separate from main photography, from film, mm-hmm. film on set photography. So we shot the whole movie and then we broke for at least 2 weeks, if not a month. And then we shot the volcap stuff in a warehouse. And volume capture, I mean, your audience is probably pretty tech savvy, but you know, motion capture is obviously the extraction of facial and body motion that is then applied to a rig that drives a three-dimensional character that artists have either created or sculpted or done. They've brought it to life somehow in a way that usually is not a human, but something else. So all that motion capture cameras are doing is they're gathering three-dimensional data points for each of the limbs and the face in a way that will drive that character. Volumetric capture, on the other hand, is 260 4K cameras that are basically, your audience probably knows this, but there's a thing called photogrammetry in computer graphics mm-hmm. where you bombard an object with hundreds of photos, and then you use computer programs to extract three-dimensional objects out of those photos. But one of the things you get with photogrammetry that's really cool is you get all of the surface texture data, not just a 3D object. So, you know, because a 3D object could look like a gray CAD model, but photogrammetry comes in with all of the reality of what the human eye sees, with all of the imperfections and the paint color and the shadows and everything. So volumetric capture is photogrammetry happening at least 24 frames per second. So you're getting your actor in hair and makeup and wardrobe mm-hmm. as they would appear in the movie, but you're getting them three-dimensionally as a chunk of geometry. And each frame is a different piece of geometry. So radically different than motion capture. There are no bones or rigging system running through that character. There is nothing you can adjust. They are mm-hmm. locked into what they are, which is a piece of 3D video. It's moving geometry.
That's cool. Because so conceptually, it seems like the evolution of maybe what we saw from Bullet Time on The Matrix, which mm-hmm. I know a lot of people like that's a sense of like a camera moving around a space with a frozen image. But also, like, I've read a lot about what James Cameron did with Avatar and his, like, you know, almost like 3D shooting and using a virtual camera, except now you have this sort of virtual capture of a physical, you know, an actual actor in a physical set. That seems really cool.
Yeah, exactly. It's you end up with, in a world where the resolution wasn't an issue, you would end up with a photoreal three-dimensional capture of that performance, which is a really weird thing to wrap your head around. So as an example, these scenes can be viewed in virtual reality, in true virtual reality, like for real, with no gimmick, like just for real. So you can,
and it wouldn't look like a 360 degree video, right? Like it'll look like proportions are all right.
Exactly. And if your volume that your VR setup was big enough, you could walk around Carly and her childhood home and the sanitarium. You could walk everywhere.
Are you guys going to release that like as an experience?
Yeah. I want to upload the simulation scenes in VR. Yeah,
that's cool.
There's a company in the Czech Republic who did all of the CG, who I absolutely love, called UPP. And UPP is, now that the movie's done, they're creating these scene files that are each of the simulations. So you can, if you have a like a nice headset, like something with, you know, something like an HTC Vive Pro, you could watch the scenes and hear them acoustically correctly and stuff.
That's really intriguing. So I saw the trailer for this film, and I still haven't seen the film yet, but I'm looking forward to it. From the bits I've seen, it does look like, you know, you're using volumetric to create this like really almost ethereal capture of certain scenes. And I assume you have a virtual camera there. Does that give you the freedom to basically shoot it however you want once you have the whole scene captured?
Exactly. Like, I mean, the thing, again, this is another way to differentiate it from motion capture. In a motion capture virtual camera setup, you're filming a proxy of what, you know, you're getting a camera motion, which is cool, but you're still witnessing a proxy of what the movie will become, because that's going to be handed off to a VFX department to bring to life. In this scenario, what you see in the camera when you're shooting it is literally what the movie is, because it's in real time. I mean, it's a really strange concept, and that's why it's applicable to VR, because it's being calculated in front of your eyes.
That's interesting. Did you find this to be a useful tool during the pandemic when, you know, right now you're capturing this physical set, but it almost seems like you could use this in many different ways, or capture this stuff remotely, and if you're on the other side of the planet, you can actually frame it and shoot it the way you exactly want it, even if you're not there, right? It seems like it's pretty flexible.
That's exactly actually what we're doing on this new project. And Demonic had that happen as well, because the VFX company was in the Czech Republic and I was in Canada, and normally I would be with them there, but we couldn't do that. So that's exactly what happened. I mean, you know, everything can be split apart and done remotely.
Gotcha. And you mentioned the stuff is being captured in real time, so you have like this sense. But I've also talked with a couple of VFX folks who are really intrigued by the idea of real time visual effects. You know, the idea that, what you're generating from your video card, you know, for a video game could be good enough to go in a movie. Is that something you've explored? Because the OAT stuff seems like you're almost getting there.
Well, I mean, not almost. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie does that. This is the movie has 15 minutes of scenes rendered on graphics cards, which is insane. Oats, if you look at Adam from Oats, that is entirely rendered in real time. I mean, it's built in Unity. That's another example. We actually got that to work in VR too. You could watch Adam in VR. Yeah.
Very cool. Like, you know, this seems like it's a lower budget project than what you've worked on in the past. How does it feel like? Kind of, it almost feels to me a little bit like District 9, sort of like seeing that for the first time, or your early shorts, like going back to basics. Did you find that, you know, to be freeing, to be away from the Hollywood machine a little and, you know, flex your creative muscles?
I mean, I don't really view it as actively kind of distancing myself from Hollywood. It's more a case of, because I love the creative outlet that appeared to be happening in the Blair Witch Project and in are normal.
Right, right.
It felt like with the pandemic, it was just a cool time to go off and do it. I think you can be equally creative in almost any situation. As long as the film is set up correctly, you should be fine.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I just reviewed for my movie podcast, you know, M. Night Shyamalan's new movie, which was also independently produced, and he went out and just shot that in the pandemic. It does seem like the restrictions of the pandemic has sort of like led to new bursts of creativity from some creators.
I didn't actually realize that with his film, that's how it came about. That's cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to see it.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued by him. And you were talking about, you know, you're working on video game stuff as well. Can you give us a sense of what's going on there? I was one of those people really hoping to see the Halo project eventually. But you think in video games in particular, like what are you dabbling in?
So I'm like officially part of Gunzilla, which is a new AAA studio that is based in Kiev and Frankfurt. And we're building, like I'm on the development team building a multiplayer shooter. So yeah, okay. So it's like, I mean, it's pretty cool. You know, I'm part of the team, which I love, and I'm not as experienced at all as anybody in there, considering I've made zero games, but I can bring an aesthetic point of view to it. And they don't really need to explain that much. Just coming from a background in VFX, it carries over like perfectly. It's more, what's much more of an unknown is the actual theory behind game design and the architectural structure of what's happening behind the scenes.
Interesting. I've liked everything you've been producing for the Oats studios, those shorts. Has those experiences kind of like led you to this project or what you're thinking about for the games? And will we see any of those expanded eventually?
Yeah, I mean, one thing with Oats is that it shouldn't ever touch Hollywood at all. Like that is something should be totally, I mean, it's actually closer to the games industry than it is to the film industry. If you think that that game studios are, that they're these studios that are filled with creative people and the entire product is made under one roof. You know, I wanted to try to do that with film. So you'd have, The only examples I can think of are animation studios, but I wanted to do that with live action. So, I have a lot of plans for Oats in future, but it's like it's 100% separate from Hollywood. But I do think that the kind of down and dirty, you know, shoot from the hip way that we made the Oats stuff made the way that we made Demonic possible. Like I'm not sure that, you know. Pre-Oats, I probably would have tried something that felt really much more like Paranormal Activity, as opposed to like, well, let's just go wild and try to, you know, try to make it look bigger than it actually costs and see what happens.
Gotcha. Cool. Well, I know we're running out of time soon. So last question for you, what was your biggest challenge, you know, dealing with using volumetric capture in such a, you know, extensive way? I think you were saying this has the most volumetric footage of any film ever released. So, you know, what were the issues that you guys had to deal with for that?
There were many issues. I mean, I think the most mentally taxing is just shooting it, because you're trying to get emotional performances from the actors who are both awesome, like Carly Pope and Natalie Bolt, but they're in constrained, horrific, you know, cage-like conditions. With like not only did we have the larger 4 meter volume cage, but we also built these small hemispheres of like another cage of other multiple cameras to be brought in closer for higher resolution. And so that was probably the hardest. And the other thing is, in the movie, she covers, you know, some distance. Like she walks through her childhood home. Okay. So if you imagine walking through your childhood home, you're walking a lot more than a 4 meter square. So you have to map out, like from an aerial point of view, you have to map out like how many 4 meter grid squares do you need as she moves through the house, and how is she changing direction, and which, you know, where are the doors and how is she opening doors and stuff. So there's like a math component, then there's a performance component, and it's all within this hyper difficult environment to shoot in. And then once it comes out of there, you still have 8 months of work putting it together. So it's hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. So I'm looking forward to seeing the VR experience, if you guys can, you know, get that delivered. And it also sounds like you have all this footage. I think a lot of people would enjoy just like cutting some of this and choosing their own camera angles like making their own short movies out of your movies. So I wonder if that would ever be possible.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, you know, again, going back to Oats, like we released all of the 3D assets as DLC items on on Steam. So I love that idea. Totally, we'll do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Neil.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to pause the recordings here, but that was a great chat. Thank you so much. And sorry for, you know, all the